This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Yo koso. Haere mai. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Dunedin Otaru Sister City Society podcast. I'm your host today, Nathan Woodfield, a member of the Sister City Society. I'm here today for a seventh episode. In today's episode, I join Blair Strong at his Japanese knife shop called With Knives, possibly the southernmost Japanese knife shop in the world. We learn about how he started his shop and what makes Japanese knives uniquely sought after around the world. We also follow the journey of how a knife is sharpened. So without further ado, please join me with Blair Strong at his shop With Knives, located at 32 Hanover Street in Dunedin. Hello, this is Nathan Woodfield, and I'm here today in the store of With Knives with Blair Strong. Thanks for joining the show today, Blair.
Thanks for having me on the show. Yeah, brilliant. It's great.
It's been really great to meet you because, you know, I saw a post online about the With Knives store, and you know, I was so interested to see this shop, and I'm really glad to have you know, had a chance to come here and get to meet you and hear your story, and it's been really exciting to hear about the story as well. So maybe just to start, could you tell us where we are today? Because this is such an incredible shop to walk in. You know, well worth, you know, even just visiting this place to see the cool displays that are here.
Yeah, well, we're at 32 Hanover Street, which is and upstairs at 32 Hanover, which is above Rembrandt Men's Clothing Store. I'm down a fairly long hallway, and yep. Then you come into a little shop that's taken me a few years to build up to this stage.
So keep walking.
Keep walking. Yeah. And then in here, I've got quite a few display cabinets full of handmade Japanese knives, some factory-made Japanese knives.
Wow.
I've got old museum display cases. And I've got my pride and joy, my Pikes Whetstones case, which is Pikes was an American whetstone company, but I keep my Japanese whetstones in there.
And whetstones are used to sharpen knives,
yes,
aren't they?
Yeah, for sharpening, repairing. I have a selection from my suppliers in Japan, and then I also have a selection of vintage stones which I've picked up and repaired over in New Zealand.
Wow.
And then also a few little Japanese natural stones as well.
Yeah. And it's not just knives and whetstones as well, but you've got a few sort of Japanese cooking implements here as well.
I have cooking implements. I also have some pottery as well, some Japanese ceramics which I've brought over, and also fishing. So I have over there, there's some shinkajime, which is for basically killing your fish after you've caught it to keep the meat in a good condition, and some new fishing lures made in the shape of knives, which I've had some people test, and they said that the fish like them because they're nice and shiny.
Right. So there's definitely a few hobbies, and there's absolutely something for everyone, no matter what sort of house you have. You know, there's going to be something that you'll find actually really useful here in your day-to-day cooking and or catching fish or preparing fish as well. And and the different styles of knives, you know, are often suitable for the different types of cooking you might do, or there's also the sort of the generalist knives as well.
I have a very large selection of knives here. Different shapes for, like you say, different purposes. But mainly the ones that I sell are the sort of all-purpose knives that you can use for everything. And I have a range from, you know, 35 up to close to $1,000 if you want to spend the money on
a knife. So full range of people's budgets, and how many knives do you think you'd have in here right now, just a ballpark sort of?
I think I have on the website 100 and 110, 120 maybe different types of knives. And then, yeah, so with stocks, I'll probably have somewhere around 200 or 300 knives.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's just such a cool display cabinet with the lights there that you've got. And, you know, you can really see the craftsmanship because a lot of the knives are just made in such a sort of a different way. And they sort of, I suppose they're almost sort of showing off their skills in how they make it. Because, you know, some of them have the hammered sort of look. You know, I'm going to be using the wrong lingo. Don't take me as the expert here, so please, the expert. So, you know, to me, they look sort of hammered. Other ones sort of have like a pattern in the steel and different handles and everything. Yeah,
there's a little bit of everything. There's different types of finishes that are quite traditional finishes. You start with the black-looking knives.
Yeah.
That's Kurochi.
Yeah.
Which basically translates to blacksmith finish.
Right. Yeah.
Kuro. In French, that's called brut de forge.
Oh, okay.
It's a common finish around the world
that
people have done. And then, like you say, with the hammered marks, Tsuchimi.
Yeah.
Which basically is just the imprints of the hammers, because a lot of the knives that I sell are traditionally forged. So they use a spring hammer, which is a machine.
Yeah.
Very old sort of style of forging still. And so it works with a pedal, kind of like a sewing machine. So they can speed up the hammering or slow it down.
Right. Yeah.
With certain different hammers, you can create patterns.
That's a really good analogy. The sewing machine, you know, just going up and down, up and down.
It's exactly the same movement, isn't it?
Just slightly altered.
A little bit more, a little bit heavier.
Gosh.
And then there's also other finishes, Nishiji, which is pear skin finish as well.
Yeah.
And then you have your polished finish, which is the Migaki.
Okay. Get a more mirror-like sort of finish. So I suppose just like, you know, if you think of the average household, the knife there, it's sort of like a machine, like a flat piece of steel that's been stamped and sharpened. So, you know, these are sort of, compared to that, like a handmade knife, is one person that's sort of carefully gone through and designed the knife and
So different areas of Japan, there's different production methods, different forging methods as well. In some areas, it's still just that one person forging the knife, grinding the knife, polishing the knife and sharpening it, putting the handle on. Other areas like Sakai. A lot more artisans are involved. So one person that only forges, it'll move on to the next person that does the sharpening.
So it's a bit of a, like, different people have got different parts of their experience in or have a different role.
And one thing they say is it's not the blacksmith that decides whether or not the blade is good, it's the sharpener. Because they're the one who's grinding the knife out of the forged piece of steel. Yeah.
Doesn't matter how expensive it is. If it's blunt, it's blunt, isn't it?
So the more people involved, the higher the fit and finish and the higher the price.
Wow. And you're saying before you've got over 100 knives here, and I see just as I arrived today, you're opening up a new shipment that came through just today.
That's from a blacksmith down in Shimabara, Nagasaki.
I've been there. Oh, beautiful city.
It's got a long history. I believe there's a samurai fort in the middle of it.
You can go to the castle there and go in it as well. I think, like most castles in Japan, that sort of the bit above the stone, so stone base had burnt down at some point. Whether it was in war, I can't remember. But really worth checking out. You know, it's so interesting seeing the history there, and they've got, you know, be it samurai swords or the sort of armor that they wear, and the kabuto, I think, is the helmets, and a bit of the local history shown there.
Yeah, there's actually a video on YouTube showing the blacksmith, which was done from the people at the castle.
So right.
They have a few people that take people around on tours, and they went down to the blacksmith shop and did a video down there.
So,
good one to find on YouTube.
Yeah. And so how did you sort of build up this relationship with, you know, people? Because it sounds like you've got connections all throughout Japan with these, you know, expert knife makers, and you know, you've been in this business or industry for a long time, because I think you started buying knives and selling them around 2013, and that sort of evolved to this shop you have today.
So I'm a chef by trade. I started working in kitchens in the early 90s, and I trained in the mid 90s up in Auckland. Before I moved to Queenstown and lived there on and off for about 20 years. And so I started buying knives because I like Japanese knives. My first Japanese knives I got in the 90s.
Yeah.
My first handmade Japanese knives I got in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And at that time, it was very difficult to even buy a really well-made Japanese knife outside of Japan. Not many shops. I was in Europe at the time, and there was no shops in Europe that were selling these kinds of knives that I knew of.
Pretty much before online stores really were around, so some of those years.
I was lucky enough to find a shop, a very famous knife maker that sold overseas.
Did you sort of email them or have to give them a call?
It was a bit of a process. Sort of choose a knife and email them, and then they would get back to me as to how long it would take.
Because
sometimes they don't have them in stock and they have to forge them, so
custom order just about. So a lot easier today, because you can just go to your website withknives.com and just click. That's it. You know, you don't have to be going out in the field there to establish these relationships to pick up these knives in such a wide range in one shop. And is it correct that this would probably be the, you know, southernmost Japanese knife shop in the world, perhaps?
Maybe the most southern Japanese. Yeah. It's definitely the only one in the South Island in New Zealand.
Yeah.
There's only a couple of Japanese knife shops in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Definitely the only one in the South Island.
Yeah. So I might have to check out if there's any in Chile or something.
There might be one in Argentina, but I don't know if it would be
quite a south.
Quite a south, yeah.
Watch out, Antarctica. That could be the competition.
Actually, I was just up in Christchurch seeing a friend of mine who's off to Antarctica.
Right.
Well, he's probably going down there on Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you supply him a knife to?
He has bought a knife from me previously.
There you go.
Yeah.
So.
But that one's over in America where he lives.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, of course. Because a lot of Americans that work in Antarctica go through Christchurch to go down, is
correct.
That right?
Yeah. So he's going down to do some sciencey stuff down there. Last year when he was here, he bought a few knives. So
yeah. Wow.
They got taken back to America.
That's such a cool connection there too, because I suppose, you know, I would have immediately thought, oh, okay, so this will be only New Zealanders buying from here, but you're having people that are visiting from America. And I think you said you had an overseas order just today as well.
Yesterday I sent some knives off to Canada.
Wow.
I've sent knives to America. That market's dropped off a little bit with the tariffs.
But yeah.
Canada, France, England, where else? Quite a few to Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen them sort of all around the world.
I think that's such a compliment to your store as well, and how well you're running it, that, you know, I'm sure there are other places in Canada that must have some knives, or Australia, but, you know, the how well made your website is and the extensive collection you've got here has meant, you know, people coming all the way to New Zealand to do an online order to
It's also the production levels of the knives in Japan are quite low for the high-end knives.
Right.
And so often, you know, you might wait 6 months to 2 or 3 years to get your order filled.
Wow.
So if someone's after a specific knife by a specific knife shop or knife maker, they'll look all around the world. And if they're sold out everywhere else, and they're not sold out here, that's why they come here.
Gosh. Yeah. That's so amazing, because I suppose, you know, like a pressed knife, you know, a machine's doing that, maybe you could make hundreds a day, but if someone's sort of doing these high-end forged knives, I don't know if you've had a chance to talk to them on how long it takes, but, you know, I presume it, you know, they're not just pumping out 100 a day. It's probably, you know, maybe one a day or less than that. I don't know. It's sort of...
The knives that I just received from Yoshimitsu, Aide-san, he says he makes 2,500 to 3,000 knives per annum.
Right, in a year. Yeah. Okay.
And that's just the knives. He also he's also a village blacksmith, so he produces a lot of other tools and does other things as well. So he has about another 100 or so products that he makes.
Gosh, that's quite an extensive set of skills he has there, isn't it?
Yes, and he's a solo blacksmith. He took over after his father passed away a few years ago.
Yeah.
And so production levels have dropped because there's only one person in the shop now.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, but big responsibility to hear it.
yes. Yeah. But then he's had three daughters, so...
Yeah.
When he retires, that will be the end of the shop.
Ah, okay.
He's third generation, but none of his daughters want to become blacksmiths.
Yeah.
Even though there are some female blacksmiths in Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is, even though the knives are becoming more and more popular around the world, it is slowly dying off in Japan.
It's a big dedication, I suppose, to sort of commit to, you know, learning the trade, because, you know, it must take a long time to learn to get to that level of competency that you can continue that reputation. And you know, I personally love the Japanese countryside. It's such a beautiful place to be and live, but many people in Japan, I suppose, are still moving more and more to the city, even though the population in Japan as a country is dropping. The cities are still growing in size. Tokyo is getting bigger. Osaka is getting bigger. So it's actually the countryside that's dropping twice as quick, where I suppose some of these makers might be.
Yeah. And the makers in the cities are getting driven out by the growth in the cities as more and more people come to the cities.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want a noisy knife manufacturer near them.
Right. So,
That's another thing that is happening with the blacksmiths.
Like that sewing machine, like sort of hammer thing you mentioned, you know, I could imagine, like, I don't know, you came off night shift and then if that shop started up, like, you'd be like, oh gosh, okay, let's...
Yeah, it's a noisy, it's manufacturing. Like you say, there are some out in the countryside. Their local markets are getting smaller and smaller. So a lot of the knife makers in Japan still go to all the markets and have stalls, and even they're, you know, famous around the world for their knives, but they still go and sell in the markets, because that's another way to increase sales.
So, and it's been sort of an industry that I think you're saying is starting to get more global attention. I suppose partly, you know, that things like the internet is helping, you know, spread the details about Japanese knives, and people are slowly becoming more aware of the quality of them as well.
Well, 20 years ago in a kitchen, you wouldn't really see very many Japanese knives. So they're an oddity.
Yeah.
Whereas now you walk into a professional kitchen and, you know, it's quite a common sight to see Japanese knives.
Yeah.
But then also my main market is home cooks.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's if you've got a beautiful knife that's really sharp and cuts like a dream,
yeah,
makes you want to pick up and cook.
Right, you know, this could be a bit of an investment in your health as well, you know. You might actually be motivated to actually use it more because you enjoy using the tool. And
Yeah, and that's why, you know, the different finishes, as we discussed before, appeal to different people. So,
yeah,
you know, if that knife looks good, you want to use it.
Yeah. Wow. That's such a fascinating history there too, isn't it? And just as I look around the store, you know, you've got a lot of interesting things from Japan, including like the Japanese flag there. And you've got these sort of traditional Japanese aprons called maikake. And, you know, of course, I expect to see ones with different Japanese logos on them. But I see that there's actually one with your own logo there with knives on the maikake, the Japanese apron there. Maybe you could share with us how that came about.
Yeah, well, the knives that arrived today from Yosemitsu, Aide-san's wife made that apron for me. She got it printed. And it was a very nice surprise in one of the boxes that arrived.
That's such a special relationship.
It is. I've been working with them for a few years. So
yeah,
it's definitely going to be one of the first stops when I get to Japan.
Yeah. It would be quite exciting to sort of see them in person as well, because you would have been talking for so many years as well. And it's quite a cool complimentary trade that they have there too, that, you know, she's able to make these clothing items related to knife making or using knives, and he makes the knives himself.
He's a third generation maker, and his grandfather started the shop in 1937, I think.
Yeah.
And even his mother now makes all the beautiful gift bags for the knives. So she was a tailor.
Oh, this one here, yes.
Yeah, she was a tailor before she retired. And she still helps out in the shop and makes some beautiful things to complement Aide-san's beautiful knives.
Because I think one of the things that sort of is quite a Japanese culture is importance is placed not just on the item itself being good, but also, you know, packaging and presentation of the item is really important as well. So it's really cool to see some of these cases for the knives here. You know, it's sort of a beautiful green fabric with a green rope there to tie it together, and
the rope that's the string that's tying it, that's a traditional, I'm not too sure on the name, but that's another traditional weaving practice, I believe.
Right, yeah.
It kind of, as there's a special way, and it just locks in, and the weave holds the string against itself, so it doesn't unlock so easily.
Yeah. So she might be working with like a local, you know, fabric maker there as well. So it's you know, they've got a lot of manufacturing capacity.
I have the knife roll there with it's got a samurai.
Yeah.
The brightly coloured one.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
That one there.
Yeah.
That's made from old shop display flags, I believe.
Oh, okay, that's really cool. That's they're quite colourful, aren't they? Sort of dyed in the bright colours, and, you know, from a shop perspective, I suppose it's a bit like that to get attention. But, you know, it's a very cool Japanese art style that they have for that too.
Yeah, it's a beautiful little knife roll
because it looks hand dyed. I think possibly it's you know, you can see the different brush strokes, so whether it was printed or I'm not sure, but
really it's quite cool
picture. Yeah, gosh,
yeah, the hand dyeing is the Sakai Kikimori piece, the panel on the door there,
right?
So that's a traditional dyeing process there.
Yeah,
Sakai Kikimori is another knife shop that I deal with.
Yeah.
From Sakai.
Yeah.
And they've been around for a long time, since 1926.
Yeah.
And they They sell very, very high-end knives, a lot more polished and finished.
Yeah.
And they deal with some of the best blacksmiths in Japan as well.
Wow. And so if you were to buy a Japanese knife for the audience, you know, what is there anything worth sort of thinking about or considering in particular? And, you know, in terms of whether it be knife care or, you know, I think I've been to many households that they have blunt knives, you know, they just buy it and then they never sharpen it sort of thing. So I suppose it's probably worth picking up some sort of sharpening implement.
Yeah, well, I do sell the whetstones.
Yeah.
Whetstones and polishing stones.
Yeah.
It is a good skill to have.
Yeah.
To be able to sharpen a knife.
Yeah.
Once you learn a good way of sharpening knives, because there's, you know, lots of different ways to sharpen a knife.
Yeah.
There's lots of ways to shorten the lifespan of your knife,
yeah,
sharpening it incorrectly.
Right, yeah.
So I do take sharpening lessons.
Okay, well.
Yeah, at the moment, they're a little bit sporadic.
Yeah.
But, I'm trying to get that a little bit more consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're interested on that, I suppose just send you a message on your website. And
Yeah. And I'll be able to hopefully tell you when my next class will be.
Yeah. So don't be intimidated. You know, even if you don't know how to sharpen a knife, there's experts here to help you learn that and do that as well.
And with the knives, often when people first buy a Japanese knife, it's good to get a stainless steel knife.
Yes.
Japanese still make a lot of knives out of carbon steel.
Yes.
Carbon steel does rust if you don't take care of it.
Yeah.
But it is easy to take that rust off.
Yeah.
The beauty of carbon steel is that it gets very, very sharp.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And it's easy to sharpen in comparison to stainless steel. Stainless steel is actually quite difficult to sharpen.
Yeah.
To get a good edge.
Yeah.
But carbon steel is quite easy, and you've brought some knives along.
Yes. So when I was living in Kumamoto, I sort of picked up a couple of knives there. Now, I don't know really anything about them. They're just sort of given to me. So, you know, they were just the knives that I had, and that's sort of all I knew about them. I've done probably a poor job of sharpening them over the years, but, you know, it was probably better than what it was because they were quite blunt when I got given them.
Yeah.
But it's ones that I've picked up since then and continue to use, and you know, they've lasted really well, so I've probably had them almost 10 years. Yeah,
they've had a lot of use, but they're still in pretty good condition in comparison to some of the knives that I see. This one here is a stainless steel stamped one. With a 2-pin handle, nice wooden handle.
Ooh.
We'll put a bit of wax on that and make it
a little bit of
TLC and bring it back a little bit. This is a stamped one from, what's the name there?
That one's Noshu Magoroku. So, and you knew the city that's from too, didn't you?
I believe these are made in Seiki City. Seiki is a bit more mass manufactured knives.
Yeah.
Larger factories.
Yeah.
A lot of more machinery.
Yeah.
Sometimes robots, but often there's still a lot of people involved in the processing of those knives.
Yeah.
So even though they're sort of more mass manufactured, a lot of hands are involved as well. So
yeah, that's really cool.
And this other one that you've got, which we couldn't quite decipher,
it's got a very cursive script. So the first knife that we showed there, that stainless steel one, it's written in a very legible script on the knife in terms of who the maker is. But the other one, it's got this pretty wild cursive script sort of mimicking brush strokes. So it's sort of like if you're reading like a letter from, you know, 200 or 300 years ago in English, you know, it's a bit hard to sometimes make out, okay, what letter is that? And the same thing with the Chinese characters or the kanji. It can be quite hard to distinguish that unless you know the brush strokes. And you know, I can read a bit of Japanese, but I think even Japanese people struggle with some of the brushstroke things as well, because you don't really learn them, just like we don't really learn cursive handwriting to the same extent anymore.
Yeah. And so, sometimes, I can decipher and figure out what the knife or who the knife maker is. But with others, it is quite difficult, because often they might be manufactured by one manufacturer, and then rebranded as a shop brand or something like that. So that's quite common in the knife world, to have a manufacturer that does OEM products.
And, you know, I'm not sure how old it is, so it could be that that knife maker no longer even exists as well, which would make it all the more harder to figure out.
And with sort of vintage knives, it is quite difficult, because if they were made sort of pre-1990s, and the shop shut down pre-1990s, there won't be much information on the internet about them.
Yes, and I'm almost certain that's a pre-1990 knife. Just from when I received it, I'm almost certain it's pre-1990.
Yeah. It's still got a lot of life in it. It's stainless steel, but this one's got a carbon steel core, so you get the best of both worlds.
It's
rather than going a full carbon knife where the whole thing will rust. Only the edge will rust, but we can see on the spine, you can see the core steel on the spine.
Yeah,
it's got a little bit of patina. The patina is the coloration of the carbon steel.
Right.
Patina is okay, because that actually protects the knife against rust. It's just the yellow rust. When you see yellow rust, that's what you want to remove.
Yeah, right.
Because the yellow rust will start eating into the steel, whereas the patina will, like I say, protect it and make it a little bit less rusty.
So that's so cool. So, you know, just like the different manufacturing styles there, you know, just in those two random knives they happen to have, you can see such a different style of
This one's got a bit more sort of consistent machining on it.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, the machining, the scratch patterns, I can sort of say that would have been done on a wheel by hand rather than you know, by a machine or a robot or something like that.
Yeah. Sort of like looking at a brush stroke in a painting or something.
And often with a knife, you'll get a little bit of, you can still see some of the scratch pattern, because it helps with the way the knife cuts through food.
Right, okay.
So if a knife is really, really highly polished, you get food. You get food sticking to your knife.
Yeah, because, so smooth.
Yeah, because it's so smooth, there's no... Yeah, you need a little bit of resistance to let the food release off the knife, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's some of the finishes that we talked about before.
Yeah.
Some people say that creates a little bit of food release off the knife as well, because,
Especially the hammered finish, is that right?
Yeah. It gives a little bit of texture to create an air pocket where the food will release off the knife.
Yeah. And I do notice that with the two knives there, when I'm cutting with the stainless one, which is comparatively mirrored to an extent, and that one does tend to stick a bit more than the other one. So
Food release is something that some people look for in a knife, but it's a very, very small part of the knife, really.
Yeah.
You won't get... If you buy a $700-$800 knife, it's not necessarily going to be any better food release than a $200 knife.
Right. Yeah. You're not able to sort of, that's not the distinguishing feature of
the
knives.
No, it's difficult to sort of quantify that. Often with food release, it comes down to your knife skill techniques as well.
Right. So you might just have to practice a bit more on how
But like this. You say, this knife, it probably would stick a little bit more.
Oh gosh, that's so interesting. And so we'll take a small break here and come back with having a look at the process of sharpening the knives, and we'll sort of talk you through that. And and if you're interested, you can sign up for a class for that as well. And so now we are here at the sort of polishing station, as it were, and we've got this sort of rather big machine here.
Yeah, so this is a horizontal water wheel. It's a small version. You can get them a lot bigger, which one day I'll have a bigger one.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is my sort of where I do the heavy work for sharpening and polishing and that kind of stuff. I'll do a little bit of work on this, and then I'll move on to the whetstones and finish by hand.
Right. Yeah. Brilliant. Oh, so we'll be able to hear and see this process, which is really exciting. And I'll take some photos of befores and afters as well, so you can sort of see what you get to, achieve out of doing this.
Yeah. Because a lot of people, they buy a knife and don't do anything with it, don't maintain it. And in a couple of years' time, it's like, well, I need a new knife.
Yeah. You don't have to throw it out. You can actually
repair it. Yeah. You can repair and maintain. So this one, your one that's got a carbon steel core, it's got a little bit of a blunt tip. So I think I'll work on that. Get that working a bit better, right?
Yeah.
So, machine on.
Spin away clockwise, and right, so it's still just like a whetstone, isn't it? But it's like moving for you, so you still add the water to
We need the water to give a stop it heating up, basically. That's why we use the water, because we don't want to heat up the steel and destroy the heat treatment.
Right.
Because once the heat treatment is gone on the knife, that's when the knife actually becomes a bit useless.
Because it's heated up and cooled down in a special way to harden it.
Yes, yeah. The heat treatment is quite a long process. It's not just one process. It's heated up and held and then dropped down in temperature really quickly, and then it goes on to some other processes as well. And different blacksmiths have different heat treatments.
Yeah.
And so, that's a very important part of the knife making, is the actual hardening of the knife.
Right.
We're just taking away some of the steel off the tip of the knife to try and... I'm not going to go from the front of the knife, I'm going to go from the back to repair that edge.
Yeah.
Quite a bit of a repair, so I'm going to go to a different style. Yeah, you can see if I hadn't done this by hand, it would have taken me probably an hour or so to get to this stage. That's about all the work I'm going to do on that. Move over to the stones.
So you've got the sort of stone in the bucket there to sort of have got the water absorbed into the stone, and
So normally, I keep some of my stones in water, not all of them. Not all stones can be soaked in water like this.
Oh, okay.
Some stones are splash and go.
Yeah.
You just need to wet them and you can go.
Yeah.
Others you need to soak for 10, 15 minutes to, like you say, waterlog the stone so that it keeps it wet, basically. And we keep on adding water to the stone as we're working as well.
You've got that sort of bottle there that you sort of splash with water as you go.
It's important to have flat stones.
Yeah.
So I'll just use a little thing to flatten my stones.
Because as you sharpen it, it'll wear down in different spots that are not going to be flat.
It'll dish. And so a dished stone is not that useful for sharpening. Because you're trying to keep a sort of set angle.
Yeah.
And if that is dished, you'd have to be adjusting that angle the whole way through that dish.
Right.
And so basically after every 5-10 minutes of sharpening on your stone, you need to flatten it again. Which is another thing which people don't really understand. And so their stone becomes dished and their knife just becomes not quite as sharp, and it's not quite as easy to sharpen.
Yeah. bit like, you know, car tires sort of wear out on the edge, you know?
Exactly, the, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's a 50-50 knife, so it will be curved on both sides quite nicely.
Yeah.
I do have right-handed knives like this, which are they're flat.
Yeah.
Which are the bottom shelf there, the vintage ones. They're flat on one side, and they've got a curve on the right-hand side, so that creates food release off that curved side.
Right.
So if a left-handed user used that knife on the flat side, the food would stick.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, that's why the sharpeners are so important. And a lot of this, a lot of the knives are done by hand.
Yeah.
Yeah. All handmade knives or, you know, hand-processed knives do have small flaws in them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, I think, is the beauty of them.
Yeah. It's a very Japanese sort of cultural buddy there too, isn't it? You know, the imperfections have beauty in it too.
A little bit of wabi-sabi.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the perfection of imperfection.
Yeah. You see it so much in Japanese pottery too. It's
Japanese pottery is just amazing.
Yeah.
Dirty work.
I guess it's partly the stone and partly the steel coming off.
So there's a mix of like you say, the stone coming off, which is the slurry, and then the steel that comes off is the swarf. The slurry on the stone, that does help cut the steel.
Yeah.
So the more slurry you have, the more cutting power you have.
Right. It's sort of like a sandpaper almost, I suppose.
Exactly. And there are lots of different types of stones.
Yeah.
You know, you have natural stones, and there's natural stones that have been used all around the world for thousands and thousands of years to sharpen and polish steel. Japanese, because of the sword culture, they kind of codified their rock stratas and a lot more so than other countries. We in Europe, we've got stones which, you know, that I still use, that Pliny the Elder wrote about.
Right. It's truly ancient times, you know, people figured this stuff out. And,
exactly. You know, a good source of grinding stone was passed on for generation after generation.
Yeah.
Now in Japan, most of the stone mines are shut.
Yeah.
So new stones are actually hard to get. They're quite difficult. And old stones are very, very expensive.
Right.
Because a lot of the supply of the older stones was bought up by the Japanese museums.
Oh, okay, just the...
Because they need to have them to be able to preserve the swords.
Oh, for the artifacts themselves, not to preserve the stone, but to preserve the... Yeah, use the stones to preserve the historical artifacts. Wow.
And I'm just trying to... follow the same curvature that was ground into the knife. I don't want to change it. I want to keep the profile as similar to the original knife makers as possible.
Sort of following the intention on what the knife will be. And
we don't want to change it too much. You only want to take off the minimal amount of steel to be able to fix it. You don't want to take off too much either. I just wanted to expose a little bit more of the core steel.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's incredible, the eye you have for this, you know, like, I feel like I can see the edge of the blade and be like, okay, I see that, that's quite easy to see, you know, you can see the edge, but to know the curvature off the side of the blade and be able to follow that, that's such an amazing skill.
Well, I've been sharpening professionally probably for... 6 years or so.
Yeah.
But I've been sharpening knives for about 30 years.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm not doing knife sharpening this year, but last year I think I sharpened around about 500 or 600 knives.
Wow. That's, you know, it's a skill from experience, isn't it?
Yeah. And not just sharpening, but also repairing knives. That's another thing on top of the sharpening is the full repairs.
Yeah. What constitutes a full repair?
Like I say, your knife is in pretty good condition.
Okay.
This is sort of pretty minor repairs in general.
Yeah.
Full repairs would be replacement handles.
Yeah.
If it is in really, really bad shape, and it's been badly sharpened for a long time, it will need to have, you know, a full reprofile of the edge.
Yeah.
Primary and secondary.
Yeah.
Some people bring in old family knives.
Yeah.
Which I've, you know, either Japanese or European style knives.
Yeah.
And they want to be able to use grandma's knife or granddad's knife.
Right, and it's possibly rusted through a bit.
Exactly. So I'll go through and take all the rust off and, you know, get it back to working condition.
Yeah. I love that it keeps the item alive. You know, it's not a throwaway culture, you know. You can keep using it.
That's why everyone should know how to sharpen.
Yeah.
So that you can keep using that item for its intended lifespan rather than shortening it.
Yeah.
And that's why buying a quality knife is worthwhile rather than a cheap throwaway knife.
Yeah.
Cheap throwaway knives, they don't use very good quality steel, and so they're not going to be sharp, and also they're going to be very difficult to sharpen.
Right.
Because the steel is not designed for sharpening.
Okay.
Whereas the cutlery steels that the Japanese makers and smiths use is designed for holding an edge and being able to sharpen as well.
Right, yeah.
Because you can, you know, there are steels out there that will hold an edge. They're amazing steels, but they're almost impossible to sharpen.
Yeah. So you might get a $200 knife, but you could keep it for as long as 10 other cheap knives that people have thrown away.
Exactly. But and a knife will not last you a lifetime, because if you're using your knife, you'll want it sharp.
Yeah.
And just the general, general sharpening will slowly reduce the life of the knife. So generally, 10 years is sort of a lifespan of a knife.
As a chef?
Chefs just have way too many knives. So usually some do. Some will sharpen and go through a knife in 5 years.
Yeah.
And then they'll just buy the exact same knife.
Yeah.
Yeah. And start that process again.
Yeah.
But a lot of chefs don't really know how to sharpen properly, I can tell you.
Bit of a secret from being in the industry.
Yeah. Most chefs are sort of pretty apathetic about their knives.
I use a computer, and some people care about the keyboard and mouse. Other people are like, oh, whatever's there, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, it's like, I'm using it all day, might as well actually get something that's good for the job. Yeah,
right. So that I'm going to jump onto a different stone now.
Oh yeah, it's like a white stone now compared to that sort of blue gray sort of color from the one before.
So the different stones are different grits, like you said before, about sandpaper. The first one that I used was, that's a 600,
yep.
600 grit. This one is, I've just jumped up to 1,000.
Right.
Yeah.
Some of the cheap artificial stones you can buy often have one grit on one side and another grit on the other, sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Double-sided stones. I do have a few of those.
Yeah.
Often when you use double-sided stones, you get a little bit of grit contamination. So if you're doing...
Right.
For most people, it's not too relevant, but if you're doing polishing or something like that, you want to have clean stones. Yeah.
So
for me, that's why I You also get, you can use these stones all the way down to the bottom, whereas with a double-sided stone, what will happen is often you'll get one side which wears a bit faster.
Oh, okay, yep. So you're going to have to throw out the whole stone a bit early, possibly.
You'll still be able to use that other side, but then you might have to go buy another.
Yeah.
So I think individual stones are a little bit better in the long run.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get a bit more use out of them.
And perfect control over what the grit is. Because you buy each stone individually, I guess, whereas the double-sided, it's like whatever the shop decided the double sides.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, sometimes, like stainless steels, you want a pretty good progression, like say, 600, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. Whereas with carbon steels, you can do quite big jumps. So you can jump from a 1,000 to a 4,000. That's not going to affect too much. Yeah. So different steels sharpen differently on different stones.
Yeah.
Yeah. The stones that I use come from a company called Imanashi.
Okay.
I'm actually not too sure where they're based, but they've been making whetstones since, I think, the 1920s.
Wow, that's the 100-year history of that industry, eh?
And they also sell Japanese natural stones. So, they're a very well-respected company in Japan. And I think they make some of the best sharpening stones.
Wow.
You see that dark? That's got a really...
Oh, wow.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's a massive change right there.
Yeah, and that, just different stones do different things.
Yeah. Wow.
So I'll give it a little bit of a Kasumi finish. So I tend to play a lot with steel and stones.
Maybe that was the other name for the shop. You might have had steel and stones.
Probably would have been a good one. Go back onto the wheel, quick little sharpen. So now I'm onto the secondary bevel. Back onto the water stones.
Yeah.
Let's jump onto this one. I'm just trying to feel for a burr as the steel gets ground away. It creates a little bit kind of plastic on the edge and creates plastic deformation, which creates a little burr.
If you can
slide your thumb off there.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And then do the same on that side, slide that way.
Oh.
Nothing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's really different, isn't it?
Yeah. So just making a little burr formation either side. Burrs there. And then I'll just take that burr off. To another stone.
Oh, yeah. That's always you've got a 1,000 grip. And
1,000 grip. So I'm going to, like I say, that's carbon steel, so I'm just going to jump up to a... ...4,000.
This is a yellow-looking stone this time, yeah. Oh, wow, the sound is very different now, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's as you talked about with sandpaper, the grits get finer and finer, so...
Wow.
Yeah.
Right, and this is sort of a leather, sort of traditional shaving sort of style.
Yeah, exactly. This one's a little vintage knife board that I got from the Kiwi knife board company.
Wow, made here. Yep. So there's a few things made in New Zealand as well.
Yeah. I think that's maybe on a bit of Kauri. So it's probably maybe 100, 120 years old.
Wow,
I've just replaced the leather on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keep the ball going.
See if that's sharp.
Wow. I'll have to take a video though. That's incredible. That's amazing.
Yeah, so, you know, that didn't take too long.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining me on the show today. What you heard right at the end there was Blair using my old knife that he had just sharpened up to cut through a piece of paper like it was going through air. Amazing stuff. I really enjoyed visiting Blair at his store to see and to learn from his incredible expertise. You can check out his website at withknives.com, as well as his Facebook and Instagram page by searching withknives.nz. So please check it out and show your support. I'll be sharing photos from the interview, showing the store and the sharpening process, including before and after photos of the knives, on the Society's Facebook page and newsletter. From here, to follow the Society and hear about our upcoming events, you can follow us on Facebook if you search for the Dunedin Otaru Sister City Society. Otaru is spelled O-T-A-R-U. We also have an email newsletter that you can sign up to. You can message a page on Facebook or email me directly at DunedinOtaruPodcast@gmail.com to sign up. This show is played on Otago Access Radio in Dunedin on the airwaves of 105.4 FM and 1575 AM, and also on its website oar.org.nz. You can also listen to us online through your favourite podcast app, including Spotify and Apple Podcast. Just search for Dunedin Otaru Sister City Society Podcast. That's Otaru spelled O-T-A-R-U. Thanks so much for listening and joining us today. O kiki itadaki arigatou gozaimashita. Till next time. Mata ne.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.